And we're underway on the recorder. So again, page 184 in your exegetical notes, verse 15 of chapter 8. All right, where have we been in chapter 8? Just quickly, in chapter 8, verse 1, we were in the prophet's present time, the end of the Babylonian exile. When we moved into verses 2 through 4, Daniel was shown a vision, and the vision began in the near future with the Persian period. In verses 5 through 22, the vision continued, but now Daniel has moved into the far future, into the Greek period. And I have a correction for you. I believe I gave you this slide from the Jewish historical book Yossi Pond, dealing with Alexander the Great's approach to Jerusalem and his meeting with the high priest. Well, on this slide, there's a Talmudic reference, and it says Yomah 39a. It should say Yomah 69a. That is a mistake in the Artscroll Tanakh series, in that commentary. So David, in the morning class, decided to look up the reference, and he couldn't find it in Yomah 39a, so he rummaged around in his resources, and he found it in Yomah 69a. So if you have that slide, make that correction if you're interested in looking up the Talmudic reference. Okay, Yomah 69a. Everybody find that okay? This should, yeah, this should be on a buff sheet there. About 10 pages back or so. Page 167, in that area, 167, 168. Yeah, it's two slides. It'll be that slide plus the map of Alexander's conquest of Medo-Persia on the bottom, okay? So that's the correction. And I did make about 10 corrected slides and put them up front if somebody needs them. All righty. Well, the most important fella to show up in the vision that dealt with the Greek period was this guy, Antiochus IV Epiphany, right? Who persecuted the Jews very severely and called himself God Manifest. Antiochus, God Manifest. I am a visible manifestation of Zeus, or as the Romans would call him, of Jupiter. Now, the abomination of desolation that Antiochus set up in the temple becomes a type of a future abomination of desolation that will also be set up in the temple. And Jesus predicts this future abomination of desolation in Matthew 24, verses 15 through 22. He calls it the abomination of desolation. He relates it to Daniel the prophet. And then he says, let the reader understand. So the reader is expected to know the book of Daniel very well so that he understands what Jesus is talking about when he talks about this future abomination of desolation. So this is a very important section of the Bible because Jesus refers to it personally here in Matthew 24. Then we finished up the class talking a little bit about the Feast of Hanukkah, and we saw, first of all, the historical implementation of the feast, which is recorded in the book of Maccabees, 2 Maccabees. We saw that in 2 Maccabees 10, 1 through 9, that when the Maccabees were guerrilla fighters wandering about in the mountains and caves of the Judean hills, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles for 8 days. And then they conquered the Greeks and kicked them out of Jerusalem and re-cleansed the temple. And in the end of that section, we read that they ordained also by a common statute and decree that every year those days should be kept of the whole nation of the Jews. In other words, the Feast of Hanukkah would be kept for 8 days, imitating the Feast of Tabernacles, because they observed the Feast of Tabernacles. Perhaps they thought that God was also among their midst, as he was in our midst during the wandering in the Sinai Peninsula for 40 years. But God was in our midst during the persecution by Antiochus Epiphanes, and we were victorious. We should never have been. So let's remember this victory with the Feast of Hanukkah for 8 days. So that's the historical fulfillment. Now the rabbis have 4 or 5 traditional fulfillments, or I should say reasons for the Feast of Hanukkah. The most common one and the most favorite one, but it is a tradition, centers around the Festival of the Lights. When the Maccabees were going to rededicate the temple, they were going to light the menorah. They only found enough holy oil to burn in the menorah for 1 day, so they lit it off anyway, and it burned miraculously for 8 days. And so the sages said an 8-day festival was declared by the Jewish sages to commemorate this miracle. But again, it's one of about 4 or 5 traditions. The only historical one we know of for sure is in the Book of Maccabees. But in spite of that, all the accoutrements of Hanukkah are in this picture. We've got the 8-branch Hanukkiah with its center branch being the Shamash candle. We've got the dreidel here and the gelt all around it and the presents. All this stuff is modern additions to the Feast of Hanukkah. It has nothing to do with the victory by the Maccabees. But of course, there are stories as to why these things exist. For example, you see the dreidel here? One of the rabbinic traditions is that, of course, Antiochus forbid the teaching of the Torah. And so the rabbis, of course, wanted to teach the Torah to the young men anyway, so they gathered them around the table and he was teaching the Torah orally, and he put a dreidel or a top in the center of the table. When the Syrian soldiers would come along and bang on the door and burst into the room, they would start that top spinning, and they'd say, "What are you doing with all these kids?" And he'd say, "Oh, we're just playing a game of top, you know." A game of dreidel. So they fooled the Syrian soldiers into thinking they were just having a game instead of a Bible lesson. But in actuality, the dreidel probably comes from Eastern Europe. Probably doesn't have anything to do with the Feast of Tabernacles at all, or I should say, the Feast of Hanukkah at all. So anyway, Hanukkah today in America has become a counter to Christmas. It's now the Jewish Christmas. So anyway, I noted for you that the temple menorah is a different menorah, 6 branches and a shamus rather than 8. And then we finish with the Jewish joke, stating that when the Jews get persecuted, it always results in a feast. For example, down here, Antiochus Epiphanes tried to destroy the Jews, but the result was the Feast of Dedication, as well as the Feast of Passover or the Feast of Purim. And the Jewish joke goes, Jewish history in 3 sentences, they tried to kill us, God saved us, let's eat. So that's where we finished last week. So we pick it up on page 184 of your outline. And verse 15 of chapter 8, with point B at the top of your outline, the interpretation of the vision. Daniel, at this point, doesn't know what it means. And so we have the appearance of Gabriel in verses 15 through 18, and he will teach Daniel what this means. Now, he'll teach Daniel what the meaning of the vision is in response to Daniel's desire to understand what he just witnessed. So we start in the first part of verse 15, point A on your outline. Chapter 8, first part of verse 15. And it came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it. So immediately his curiosity is whetted. And this is the inner desire of his heart. You know, what in the world does this thing mean? He's not indifferent to it at all. So in response to that desire in his heart, a man appears. Second part of verse 15. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. Now obviously, it wasn't just a man, because he describes him as looking like a man. If it was a man, he wouldn't have said he looks like one. So I suspect that Gabriel here, who stands before him, we'll learn in just a moment, was probably glowing with the Shekinah glory light, something like that. But notice, Daniel does not describe this man as having wings. Okay? Now, there are orders of angels that have wings. The cherubim, the cherubim have wings. The seraphim have wings. But this order of angels looks like people. No wings. No wings. Whenever there are wings on an angel, it's noted in the description. It's noted in the description. So kind of erase that idea from your mind that when men-like angels appear, they have wings. You know, that's very popular in our culture. I think of the popular Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life, and Clarence, yeah. What's Clarence doing? He's earning his wings. Gee. All right. Sorry. Clarence didn't earn no wings, folks. All right. When this another myth destroyed, another disillusioned everybody. I know. Yep. I didn't say anything against Santa Claus yet. All right. So this a man-like being appears to Daniel, and then a message is given to Gabriel, verse 16. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So now in verse 16, point C1, we hear the command of another angelic being. We know exactly where this guy is as well. The first one isn't standing before Daniel, and this guy is standing between the banks of the Ulai Canal or the Ulai River. So he's either standing on the water or he's standing above the water. So he is obviously an angel as well, because neither you and I can do that, can we? We can't stand on water. At least it hasn't happened the last time I tried it. All right, so he issues a command to teach Daniel about the vision. Now notice point two. We don't know who the speaker is for sure. He's never named. But it may be Michael, because Michael's associated with Gabriel later on in the book, and you see the cross-references there. Now, Michael is the archangel. He's the top angel in the hierarchy of angels. So he's the archangel. He does have authority to give orders like this. So apparently Gabriel is a notch below him, and he's commanded to teach Daniel. Now, of course, we learned that Gabriel was Israel's guardian angel. And so that's very logical for Gabriel to be given this command. Now, point four, if you drop down to point four, you see that this is the first mention of a good angel by name. Gabriel means the mighty one of God, Gever and El, mighty one of God. Or a mighty man of God. That's his name. So if you know anybody named Gabe or Gabriel, they have a good name, don't they? Got to live up to a name like that, don't you? Point five, we see that Gabriel shows up elsewhere in relation to Israel. Luke 1, 19 and 26, he speaks to Zechariah and he also speaks to Mary. So he's given this job of explaining God's plan to a number of different people, Daniel, Zechariah, and Mary. Very consistent job that he's given. Now, this guy's an angel, and his appearance has a very definite effect on Daniel. As Gabriel comes to explain the vision to him. So we pick that up in point D, verse 17, first part of verse 17. So he came near to where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. So now Gabriel approaches him, and literally, point one there, Daniel is terrified. He sees this guy coming at him, and he goes right down on his face. Wham! In terror. And you and I probably would do the same thing. Yeah, many people do that. Now, he did not fall down on his face to worship Gabriel. Note that. Whenever somebody falls on their face to worship an angel, like John in the book of Revelation, the angel says, "Whoa, buddy, get up! You know, none of this stuff." Okay? But here, Daniel is falling in terror. He's afraid. He's seeking some kind of shelter from this guy. But of course, Gabriel is not there to do him any kind of harm. So Gabriel's message starts in verse 17, second part of the verse. "But he said to me, 'Son of man, understand the vision. Understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end.'" All right, now he calls Daniel a son of man. Same term we've seen earlier in the book, Ben Adam. Ben Adam, one like a son of man, was brought before the Ancient of Days. There, the term Ben Adam became a technical term for the Messiah. But here, in this context, the emphasis is on Daniel's human frailty. He's like you or I. He's just a son of Adam. Or as C.S. Lewis liked to put it in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the sons and daughters of Adam. You know, we're just frail human beings. And that's the emphasis here. Daniel is but a man. So the term has a different use. It doesn't always speak of the Messiah. Now, point two at the bottom of the page. I don't care how you emphasize this point. Put four stars by it. Highlight it with a yellow marker. Put a sticky note on the page. Put a piece of gum on the page. I don't care. But note the final comment at the bottom of the page. Point two. Gabriel says the vision belongs to the time of the end. In other words, it will reach beyond Antiochus Epiphany. It's going to reach to the end of the days. So we've got to burn that into our brain when we start looking at this vision. It pertains to the end times. Very clearly, right? We got that? Pertains to the end times. It's not going to be limited to Antiochus Epiphany. Well, we'll see. We'll touch on that in just a moment. I'll answer your question in just a moment. All righty. Page 185. Well, these words do not have a comforting effect on Daniel. He's still terrified. And in the second part of verse 18, we see that he is still terrified of Gabriel as Gabriel comes closer to him. Second part of verse 18. First part of verse 18, excuse me. "Now while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground." So I don't know what goes on with Daniel here. He faints or something. He loses consciousness. Something happens to him here, and he's either physically drained or physically exhausted or so terrified that he faints, something like that. But he's unable to get up off the ground. He's down there. So Gabriel understands this, and so Gabriel meets this need in Daniel's life in the second part of verse 18. Chapter 8, verse 18, second part of the verse. "But he touched me and made me stand upright." So this angelic touch wakes him up, gets him out of this stupor, and somehow revives him. See, Gabriel doesn't want his student to fall asleep in the classroom. Is that a good application for us all here? All right. So Gabriel revives him. So if anyone falls asleep, I will revive you. Some way. I've got to start glowing. Yeah, okay. You got me there. One for Bonnie. One for Bonnie. All right, so he sets Daniel upright. Daniel is now in an attentive position to be taught the vision. He's ready to go. Maybe he gave him a shot of Starbucks there, I don't know. Angelic caffeine. And he begins the explanation of the vision in verse 19. Chapter 8, verse 19. He said, "Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointment, to the appointed time of the end." All right, point 2A, four stars, yellow highlighters, sticky note, I don't care. Note point A, where does this vision apply? At the latter time of the indignation. So this goes beyond Antiochus Epiphany. And from our perspective, we're very fortunate, you guys. Daniel didn't have our perspective. From our perspective, down the road, 2,500 some years, we know that he's going to be dealing with Antichrist, not with Antiochus Epiphany. Now, many commentators say that the end of this vision deals with Antiochus. But right here, Gabriel's telling us very clearly that it's going to go beyond Antiochus. Now, Antichrist was already introduced in Daniel 7. So it's not that he's an unknown figure, but we are very fortunate because we know a lot more about him than Daniel did. And notice point parentheses B. This vision will occur in the latter time of the indignation. Circle that term, the indignation. It's a synonymous term for the great tribulation, when God pours out his wrath and his indignation on planet Earth. So we know, we call it the great tribulation. Daniel didn't have all the information we have, but it was revealed to him that it would exist. So there's a great parallels between chapter 8 and chapter 7, point C. All right. Parentheses number 2. You already marked the page with your sticky note. Mark parentheses 2 as well. Another very important comment. Antiochus was talked about in chapter 8, verses 9 through 14, but now he becomes a type of the Antichrist in verses 23 through 25. Now, I'm very uncomfortable with just assigning typology to anything in Scripture. There has to be a good reason to do it. And I think here we have a good reason to say that Antiochus Epiphany is a type of the Antichrist, because we have Yeshua's statement that we read earlier. So basically, what Antiochus did in history, of course it's history to us, what Antiochus did in history, Antichrist will do in prophecy. What Antiochus did in history, Antichrist will do in prophecy, only more severely, much more severely. Now, of course, Antiochus and Antichrist were both future to Daniel. But we sit between those two guys. Our time frame is between Antiochus and Antichrist. Antiochus is passed to us. We have the historical records of what he did. Antichrist is future to us. I'd have to go back to that. I didn't write that down. All right, and finally, point B. Again, it's repeated. It belongs to the appointed time of the end. Again, a key comment that Gabriel makes. Again, a statement referring to the prophetic future. We're going to be dealing with tribulational events here. Tribulational events. All right. Have I beaten that into you? Okay. On page 186, at the top of the page, Dr. Fruchtenbaum has given us an expanded paraphrase of what Gabriel has said. We'll read it. If it'll help you, that's great. So I'll read it, but I'll leave out the parentheses here in the paraphrase. Basically, Gabriel says, I will cause you to know what will occur in the latter portion of the indignation, which will have long before been foreshadowed or pre-typed by the oppression of Antiochus Epiphany. This latter portion, consisting of the appointed end time of the end of the times of the Gentiles. So there's the answer to your question. This vision deals with the end of the times of the Gentiles. That's the big theme of Daniel. The four nations, the four kingdoms, the final one being Rome or imperialism that is destroyed by the coming of the Messiah and the setting up the Messianic kingdom.
The Great Tribulation is the same as the Tribulation, right?
Basically. Some people divide the Tribulation into two parts, calling the full 7 years the Tribulation and the last 3.5 years the Great Tribulation. Because Yeshua says at that time there will be a great tribulation. It's the same period of time, but I will admit things get worse in the last 3.5 years. So I don't have any argument with calling it the great tribulation. All right, point D and E are again worth circling. What was described in chapter 8, verses 9 through 14 was true of Antiochus Epiphany. And we carefully worked our way through excerpts from the book of Maccabees that gave us a detailed historical account of what happened under Antiochus Epiphany. We did that last week. You laboriously went through it with me, right? Okay? Very important. So verses 9 through 14 was true of Antiochus Epiphany. But point E, what's described in verses 23 through 25, is not going to be true of Antiochus Epiphany. He did not perform the actions mentioned in 23 through 25. Antichrist will. All right, and I'm not trying to impose a position on you. I'm just trying to emphasize what Gabriel is saying here. Not what I'm saying, what Gabriel is saying. Where does this apply? Because many commentators don't go down this route. They say that chapter 8, verses 23 through 25 is just Antiochus Epiphany again. But according to Gabriel, it's not. All right, we've looked at verses 20 and 21 a couple of times in earlier lessons. But by way of review, Gabriel interprets the meaning of the ram. In verse 20, the ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. Right? We've beaten that into you, right? Very clear. Okay, this is review, but it's important. Then he interprets the he-goat in verses 21 and 22. And we went through this carefully as well. Verse 21, first half of the verse. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. The kingdom of Greece. Now, in your outline, you see it says the rough goat. That's the American Standard Version's word. The word rough there simply means shaggy, as the NASB translated it. And the ASV uses the singular, king. But it's better to use the term kingdom there because the king will be described in just a moment. So the NASB does a better job than the old American Standard, the ASV there. So we have the kingdom of Greece. And then verse 21 goes on in part the second part of verse 21. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Okay, Alexander the Great. And we've looked at that. So very clearly, we know what the ram, or the shaggy goat, excuse me, is referring to. Then in verse 22, we look at the division of the empire among the four kings. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. And so again, four kingdoms will arise out of Alexander the Great's death. And we've looked at that over and over again. Lysimachus taking Thrace and Bithynia, Cassander taking Macedonia and Greece, Ptolemy taking charge of Egypt and Israel, and Seleucus taking charge of Syria, a little bit of Asia Minor there, and points east. But none of these kingdoms ever had the power and glory and reach of Alexander. Alexander the Great was much more powerful than any of his successors. All right. Review is over. Review is over. Now, as we move in page 187, to verses 23 through 25, we're going to move into new material. And in doing so, we're going to change our time frames. Now, up on our time frames chart, you see that currently Daniel, in this vision, it has been projected into the far future, the Greek period. But now, in verses 23 through 25, he's going to be projected even further into the future to the tribulation period. This is what Gabriel is telling him this vision is all about. Now, I want to point out on our time frame chart a pattern that shows up in the prophets over and over and over again, especially if you have a time frames chart like this. Basically, the idea is what happens back here will be repeated in the future, only much more severely. What happens back here will be repeated in the future, only much more severely. That's a standard pattern of the prophets. That's what's happening here. Verses 5 through 22, what happened under Antiochus Epiphany will be repeated in the future, only much more severely under Antichrist. Did I see a hand? No. Okay. Okay, does that make sense? And then the prophet will bounce back to his present time, and he'll go through something in the present time, and it'll be repeated in the future again, over and over and over again. You'll see this pattern. So it's very prominent here. Okay, remember, though, it's going to be much more severe when it happens in the future. All right. Well, I've got 7:45, so why don't we pick it up on verse 23 after our break? So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar. All right, we're back underway. All right, we're going to pick it up then on... before we pick it up on page 187, Dave had a comment. He said back on page 185.1a, the comment that the Antichrist had already been introduced. He asked what verse. That's verse 7:24 and following. Verse 24 and following. The little horn that comes out of the 10 and then uproots 3 and the other 7 give their power to him. That's Antichrist. So chapter 7, verse 24 and following is where he was introduced. All right, we'll pick it up on page 187 in the first part of verse 23 with the timing of this explanation about the Antichrist. And by the way, the genre changes here. The style changes to poetry. The NASB makes that very clear in their setup. But if your Bible doesn't show it, it's a little change in genre here, which shows a new section. All right. Let's start first part of verse 23. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course. All right. When is the timing of this event? In the latter time, again, an indicator of the prophetic future. Point B, of their kingdom. That's the literal Hebrew. The NASB says the rule. Now, he's not talking about one of the four kingdoms of the Greek or Hellenistic Empire. Verse 22 is in the plural, but verse 23 is in the singular. He's now dealing with the latter time, point two there, of the Gentile kingdom, the times of the Gentiles. So this is the end of the times of the Gentiles. That's what he's talking about. Now he describes the times of the Gentiles. Point two, when transgressors have come to the full. That's another way of describing the Great Tribulation. When God has allowed transgression to get to its fullest extent, and he will not allow it to get any worse. So this will occur at the apex of transgression, at the apex of sinning, at the top of the Mount Everest of sin. This has not occurred yet. We think it's bad today, right? It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. And again, point three, the section is not interpreting verses 9 through 14. It's new information here, parenthesis 3. We're talking about new information. And again, I know some commentators feel this speaks only of Antiochus. But Gabriel has told us something different. All right, so that's the timing of these events. Now a description of the Antichrist is found in verses 23 through 25. Middle of verse 23 through verse 25. A king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. And he will even oppose the prince of princes, and he will be broken without human agency. 14 statements about Antichrist. 14 statements about this guy. And I'll just read them out of the outline, which of course has the wording of the American Standard Version. It sounded a little different out of my New American Standard. I'll just read it out of the outline here. First of all, a king of fierce countenance will stand up. The word there means insolence. He will be merciless and insolent. So he's going to be a cruel individual, uniquely cruel. Number two, he understands dark sentences. And the literal Hebrew there speaks of the untying of knots and the solving of riddles. And this is not entertainment that he's going through. He's not a Boy Scout, nor is he playing a game. This untying of knots speaks of overcoming intellectual roadblocks, overcoming intellectual barriers. He's able to overcome obstacles in his way, obstacles that other people cannot overcome, just like that knot you can't untie in your shoelace. He can untie it. He'll be able to solve riddles. This speaks of solving difficult problems. So he'll think of solutions that no one else can think of. He'll overcome barriers that no one else has been able to overcome. Toward the bottom of the page, notice parentheses C. Daniel was described with the same terms. In chapter 5, verse 12, Daniel was described as a man who could untie knots and solve riddles. But Daniel did it through whose power? God's power. This guy will do it through another source of power, which we'll see in just a moment. So he will be astounding in the same way that Daniel was astounding to his peers. Point three at the bottom of the page, his power will be mighty. The indicator is that he'll be militarily strong. Militarily strong. He will command all the armies of the world. And he'll gather them together at Armageddon. So he will be militarily strong. He will win the wars that he instigates, and then he will command the world's armies. Of course, I'm speaking out of the book of Revelation there. I know where he's going here. All right, page 188, point 4. He's going to be able to do all this stuff, but notice point 4, not by his own power. The source of his abilities is going to be satanic. You know, Satan is the prince of the power of the air. Satan is going to be cast down to planet Earth. Satan is going to be doing everything he possibly can to defeat God's program. So this guy is going to be satanically empowered. Point 5. The ASV says he shall destroy wonderfully. That word wonderful is a Hebrew word that means wonderful in a supernatural sense, not in a human sense, in a supernatural sense. It is often used of God, Pele. The base form of the word is Pele. And you see it in the description of the Messiah, wonderful counselor, supernatural counselor. Well, this guy is going to destroy by supernatural power. So this can't be Antiochus. Antiochus is never associated with any miracles. Point 6, he will prosper. He's going to be successful. He will become the world power. He will become the world power. He will uproot 3 of the 10 kingdoms, and the other 7 will submit to him. He will be successful. Well, he's going to be revealed. So the believers, those who come to faith, should know who he is. And in the middle of the tribulation, they will be required to either renounce the mark of the beast or take the mark of the beast, and the beast would be the Antichrist there. And that's a religious symbol, by the way. It is not a computer readout or anything. It is a symbol of commitment. You either reject worshiping the beast or you accept worshiping the beast. That's what 666 is all about. So they'll know. In the tribulation period, there's going to be no gray areas. People are going to know very clearly the score. The false prophet? No, I don't believe he talks about him at all. All righty. He's going to be successful. Number 7, he will do his pleasure. In other words, he will be willful. Willful. He'll do exactly what he wants in the way he wants to do it. Deliberately malicious and willful. Like a spoiled child, only a lot worse. A spoiled child with adult toys, you know. All right, number 8, he will destroy the mighty ones. Probably a reference to the Jewish leadership in the tribulation period. And verse 9, he will destroy the holy people. That's a reference to the Jewish people. And we know from Zechariah 13, 8 and 9, I've put this up many times, that he will succeed in killing 2/3 of the worldwide Jewish population. Zechariah 13, 8 and 9. It will come about in all the land, better translated world there. It will come about in all the world, declares the Lord, that 2 parts in it will be cut off and perish. 2/3 of the worldwide Jewish community, but the 3rd part, 1/3, the faithful remnant, will be left in it. And I will bring the 3rd part through the fire of the tribulation period, refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. And they will call on my name, and I will answer them, and I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is my God. Unfortunately, it's going to take that for those of us in the Jewish community to come to that point. Unfortunately. Point 10, the 10th description of the Antichrist. Through his policy, he will cause craft to prosper in his hand. In other words, deceitful. He'll be deceitful. Craft there is not, he's not speaking of being a craftsman in wood or metal or anything. He's talking about being deceitful there, crafty, sneaky. Crafty individual, deceitful individual. Point 11, he will magnify himself in his heart. He will genuinely believe that he is God. He will make a claim to deity. I am God. He'll be so deluded himself. And Paul and John both picked this up. Your cross references, 2 Thessalonians 2, 3, and 4. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness, that's another synonym for the Antichrist, another name for him. The man of lawlessness is what? Revealed. Don't bother to look for him now. You won't know who he is. He has to be revealed. It isn't Juan Carlos. It isn't the Barack Obama. It isn't all these guys. He will be revealed. Whoever is around when he's revealed will know for sure who he is. He's the man of lawlessness, the son of destruction, another term for him, who opposes and exalts himself above what? Every so-called god or object of worship. This is going to be mono-idolatry in the tribulation period. The worship of one idol, one man. Mono-idolatry. Not monotheism, you guys, but mono-idolatry. Not polytheism. Mono, one. So that what? He takes his seat in the temple of God. So this is the third temple, the tribulation temple. We know it has to be up and running by the middle of the tribulation. He will take his seat in the temple of God, what? Displaying himself as being God. We'll talk about the origin of the Antichrist later on in Daniel. I'm going to hold off on that, okay? I just want to keep you coming. Got to keep you awake, huh? Got to keep you coming to class. All right, point B. No, his origin will be revealed to us in Daniel. Revelation 13, verses 3 through 9, the same idea. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. That's another name for the Antichrist. They worshiped the dragon. That's a reference to Satan in context there. Because he gave his authority to the beast. Satan will give his authority to the Antichrist. And so they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to wage war with him? He's militarily strong, isn't he? And there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. And authority to act for 42 months was given to him. Sound like the description we just read? Yeah, of course it is. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle. That is, those who dwell in heaven, heavenly tabernacle. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth worship him. One qualification. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. So all those who are not destined for salvation will worship him. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. But the point here is that he magnifies himself as God and receives worship as God. All right, point 12, the 12th part of the description of Antichrist. In their security, he will destroy many. We get to chapter 9, verse 27. We'll look at that in detail. But the Jewish people will feel secure, and when we do, he will launch a sneak attack. When the Jewish people feel secure, that's when he moves. Point 13. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, again referred to in Daniel 7, verse 25. He will have special antagonism against the Jewish Messiah. And then, fortunately, verse 14, he shall be broken without hand. And this broken without hand, it means not by the hand of God, not by the hand of man. He will be destroyed not by the hand of man, but by the hand of God. And that was previously stated in Daniel 7 again. But Paul picks this up in 2 Thessalonians 2:8. Then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. So when Yeshua returns, when Jesus returns, Antichrist will be doomed. Now note, I want you to note here, the power of Antiochus Epiphany was broken by whom? The Maccabees. They were very human. We looked at the history of the Maccabees. They defeated Antiochus Epiphanes. They cleansed the temple. They created an independent Jewish state for about 100 years till the Romans came along. But the Antichrist power is going to be broken by the Messianic God King, God-man King, Yeshua. The Messianic God-man King is going to destroy Antichrist. Question? Yeah, they would take this as the time of Jacob's trouble.
Yeah.
All right, page 189. In verse 26, we come to the conclusion of the vision. Verse 26, the affirmation by Gabriel. Verse 26. The vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. All right, so this vision of the 2300 evenings and mornings is absolutely true, and the assurance here is that it will come to pass. You can bet your retirement on it. It will come to pass. But what is Daniel told to do? Point B. Shut up the vision. He's told to preserve it. And Daniel did in writing. We have it right here before us in English. So Daniel did write down all that he saw. He didn't understand it all, but he preserved it for future generations. And that's the point of point C. Again, star this area. It belongs to many days to come. And from Daniel's perspective, it's going to take two phases. First, Antiochus Epiphany. In the Greek, during the Greek period of time, that's the first phase. And then the Antichrist at the end of the fourth kingdom, the second phase. Antichrist coming after Antiochus Epiphany. Antiochus Epiphany first, Antichrist second. And so now the vision ends. In verse 27, and I'm going to change my chart here a little bit. In verse 25, the tribulation period is over. We now jump back in verses 26 through chapter 9 to the present time. I'm going to change that to 27 there. I'm going to change that. I'm going to have the vision end right here because the conclusion talks about the effects on Daniel. And Gabriel is all part of this vision. So I'm going to continue the vision to verse 27.
So you're changing the prophecy?
I'm changing my chart. No, you want to claim that my chart is inspired? All right. Conclusion, the effects on Daniel. Then we go back to prose here. So this is the new section. Back to prose, so we have a new section here. New genre, new style. Verse 27, then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. And then I got up again and carried on the king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. So point one, Daniel fainted again. This is his initial reaction once the vision is over. He kind of collapses, you know, boom, exhausted again, overcome again. And he says he was sick a number of days, so the effects of this vision linger upon him. He's in his mid-60s here at this point. So he's not as strong as a young man. He will live, of course, into his 80s. So the effects linger for a number of days. He's in his bed. He's on a sick bed recovering. He's got the vision flu, say the least. He's got an emotional hangover, definitely. Definitely. All right. Then point three, he rises up off his sick bed and he does the king's business. And that's Belshazzar he's talking about. He apparently is a minor official in Belshazzar's government. So point A, the fact that he now goes about the king's business shows that he's in Babylon. Now, at the beginning of the vision, he was in Babylon, in Belshazzar's government of some sort, and we learn that he is transported in the vision to Shushan, to Susa, and that's where the vision takes place. In the capital city of the Medo-Persian Empire, the capital city to come. It wasn't the capital city at this time. But now the vision comes to an end, and he suddenly finds himself back in Babylon. The vision is over, and he has been in Babylon physically the whole time.
What's the time period of this
vision? It doesn't say. It doesn't.
Well, when is, do you know when this Susa comes
to happen? Oh, yeah, we talked about that at the beginning of the chapter. Go back in the beginning of the chapter to the opening verses. We talk about chapter 8. Yeah, that'll give you some more details on that. Question? This would be before, because the handwriting on the wall was immediately precipitated by the fall of Belshazzar. Okay, now this is before Belshazzar fell. Okay, so point B shows that he is a minor official in Belshazzar's government. Belshazzar did not know who he was. Remember, the queen mother had to come and explain who Daniel was. Hey, I know this Jewish dude who can answer the riddle of the handwriting on the wall. Remember all that? Okay, so he was a minor official, no longer a major official as he was under Nebuchadnezzar. Now notice how he describes the vision. I wondered at the vision. This means he kept meditating on it. He kept thinking it over. He had sleepless nights going over and over and over in his mind. I know because that's what I do, right? He's trying to figure out the details, but he fails. He fails. Point five. But none understood it. So apparently he shared this vision with others. But point 5a, none of the other wise men could understand the vision either. They couldn't figure it out either. He wasn't given the key to understanding this vision as he was given the key to understand other dreams in the past. And that points out to us, that emphasizes to us point B. The vision was not for Daniel's benefit. It pertains to the future. It pertains primarily to the faithful remnant who will read about this in the tribulation period. But we have the new covenant to go by too, so we are in a very privileged position. We can understand much more of this vision than Daniel ever could. Progressive revelation. All right, so the major lesson for the Jewish community, point six at the bottom of the page, that the times of the Gentiles is going to be a period of major persecution for the Jewish community, the end of the times of the Gentiles. It'll end in a major period of persecution for the Jewish community. Now, just in closing, I'm going to hand out this slide to you. We'll build it real quick. I just adapted it from Dr. Constable's chart in his notes. But there's a feature that's pointed out in this chart that I think is important to note. All right, here we go. All right, you see on your on your chart that we're going to compare chapters 2, chapter 7, and chapter 8. The metals, the animals, and the animals in both chapter 7 and chapter 8. Okay, any extras here at all? Did you get one there, you guys? Got one? Okay, you guys all set? Extras here, and a few here, and a few here. Okay, everybody have one. All right. And you need a couple there? Just one? All right. All right, let's build this chart real quickly. And I want to point out something to you. First of all, the first row, in the first row, Babylonia, Neo-Babylonia, the Babylonian Empire kingdom is portrayed by the metals of gold in chapter 2 and the winged lion in chapter 7, but nothing is said about it in chapter 8, right? Nothing. All right, in the second row, Medo-Persia is portrayed by the silver in the metals of chapter 2, by the animal, the lopsided bear in chapter 7, and by the ram in chapter 8. The third kingdom, the Greek kingdom, is then portrayed by the bronze in chapter 2, the winged leopard in chapter 7, and the goat in chapter 8. And finally, the final kingdom, Rome or imperialism, the final kingdom of the times of the Gentiles, is portrayed by the iron and the iron and clay in chapter 2, the unique beast in chapter 7, and nothing is said about it in chapter 8. So we've got a strong emphasis here. When God repeats things, pay attention to it. Here, God is emphasizing what's going to happen during the Medo-Persian and Greek empires. So it's an important section of Scripture to pay attention to, an important part of the times of the Gentiles to pay attention to. And the most important factor we've seen so far in the second and third kingdoms is the fact that they lead up to Antichrist, portrayed by Antiochus Epiphany. Okay? Antiochus Epiphany and Antichrist are very clearly brought forth in these two, in chapter 8, and the extra information given about Medo-Persia and Greece. So pay attention to that. Don't overlook it. A lot of times chapter 8 is overlooked and basically relegated to the scrap heap of history. Oh, it just talks about Antiochus Epiphany and it's all over with. But as we've seen, Gabriel has said, no, this is a very important chapter. It belongs to the end times. All right, that brings us to a close. We'll pick it up next week on chapter 9, the very famous chapter of the 77s, the Messianic timetable in chapter 9. So I expect attendance will explode. Yes. It's a difficult chapter. We'll move through it very carefully, but it's a very, very important Messianic prophecy. Okay, so let's go ahead and pray, and then I'll turn you guys loose. Father, again, thank you for your word, and thank you for this look into human history that you've given us. And we see in this this glimpse at the Antichrist that the Jewish community is in deep trouble. Not only are we heading for a godless eternity if we don't come to faith, we're heading into the jaws of the tribulation and the destruction brought upon us by the Antichrist. Lord, you burned this into my heart some 30 years ago to try and do something about this today. So I ask that you would burn into the hearts of all these students a desire to reach out to the Jewish community so that, first of all, we can come to faith in Yeshua and be saved from a godless eternity. But second of all, so that some will come to faith and be saved from the jaws of the tribulation as well and from the wrath of the Antichrist. So, Lord, I ask you to use this chapter in our lives to put a big burden in our heart to go to the Jew first, Romans 1:16, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. And I ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, thanks, you guys.